Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for another episode of the Atlanta Dealmakers Radio Show.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us. You're joining us for the Ritz Group Radio Show, part of the Atlanta Dealmakers series with the Buckhead Business Radio X. My name is Trace Crowell. I'll be hosting this wonderful episode. We are going to be diving deep into the mysteries of equity-based crowdfunding today. We've got a wonderful panel of guests with us. We've got Megan Johnson and Marcus Kennedy from Spark Market. We've got Brett Grayson, who's got a wonderful new film that is crowdfunding through Spark Market. We've got Rodney Sampson from Opportunity Hub. We've got Catherine Mobley from We Care Card. And we've got Andrew McConnell from Vacation Futures. So if you haven't been here before, how we do this normally is we just start with some interviews, and then we dive right into a roundtable. Today we're going to be discussing equity-based crowdfunding, and hopefully we'll shed a little light on what tends to be a somewhat confusing topic because of the constantly shifting and evolving landscape. So we're going to start today with Spark Market. We are joined by Megan Johnson and Marcus Kennedy. Megan is a Georgia attorney with 6 years of experience with financial transactions and general business law. She is dedicated to creating a new marketplace for quality and sustainable local investment opportunities accessible by everyday Georgia residents. And Marcus, he's the VP of Marketing and Development for Spark Market. They are doing some wonderful things. So let's dive right into it. Megan, why don't you tell me a little bit about what Spark Market does?
Sure. Thanks. So Spark Market is a local investment platform. Kind of the buzzword of the day is equity crowdfunding. But I think, you know, when I'm describing what Spark Market is, it's really helpful to take a step back and kind of create a larger context for why, you know, equity crowdfunding is so important. What we're talking about basically is the opening up of the securities marketplace for the first time in almost 100 years. So 97% of all Americans are considered non-accredited investors. That means that they have less than $1 million in assets or make less than $200,000 a year. I fit that category. My family fits that category. All of us are trapped in the investment sense and exclusively forced to invest in Wall Street, in large publicly traded companies. In recent years, Wall Street has shrunk dramatically. I thought this was fascinating. Since 1998, Wall Street has shrunk by over 50%. So that means folks like me have a lot fewer opportunities to invest in than we used to. So equity crowdfunding is just the notion of making it, of lifting securities regulations to allow small and local businesses who can't afford to go public and pay the disclosures and afford the whole SEC process of going public, just allowing them to sell stock to non-accredited everyday investors. So Spark Market is a platform where small businesses can facilitate those transactions and advertise their offerings to the local community.
Okay. And well, actually, let's take just a tiny step back. Let's, in case our audience doesn't understand, what is the difference between equity-based crowdfunding and, let's say, Kickstarter, which when people hear crowdfunding, they think Kickstarter, Indiegogo. What's the difference there? Why is this something we need to separate and talk about separately?
Yeah, great point. So, you know, the rise of crowdfunding in recent years, it's really just a form of alternative finance. And there's three main types. There's sites or, you know, websites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo that have made donation-based crowdfunding or rewards-based crowdfunding really popular. And so what that means is somebody will back a project, they'll fund or donate a project, but they don't have any expectation of a return. So it's just a donation, much like in the charitable sense, or you're pre-purchasing some product that you think is cool. Equity crowdfunding, on the other hand, and then debt-based crowdfunding, those are more traditional financial transactions. So you're actually buying stock. You're actually are taking on equity or ownership in a company.
Does it help if you're offering some rewards along with the equity?
That's one of the really exciting things. I think you're going to hear pretty soon from Rodney Sampson of the Opportunity Hub, who has really taken all the possibilities of the new crowdfunding financial tools to craft really unique securities products that include, you know, a traditional stock position in a company, as well as some perks, much like a Kickstarter type campaign. So he can tell you more about that later on. But that's one of the really exciting things right now with this new alternative finance.
All right. Yeah. So, Marcus, what is in it for local businesses and their investors to be investing in small businesses like this?
Good question. excuse me. So I'll look at it first from the perspective of business. We're on a business radio show. Let's look at it from their perspective. From a business's perspective, what they have an opportunity of doing is kind of taking in those people who are already typically very familiar with their product or their service, and for lack of a better word, co-opting them and having them become brand advocates for, again, their product or their service. So let's say I were to invest in, I'll use Rodney Sampson's campaign as an example. Let's say I was to invest in Opportunity Hub. And I'm an entrepreneur, which is true, and I need a place to work out of. So suddenly I have a vested interest in his business. I want to see it do well. So what I'm likely to do is take that message of what he's doing and put it on my social media, which is the medium of the day to communicate with our peers. So I'm going to talk about it on there. I'm going to tell my friends about it. I'm going to push other entrepreneurs who I know are in a similar situation to go check out this cool thing that's happening downtown on Peachtree Street. So it's not as though the business has asked me to do anything that I wasn't already going to do. I already use this service, I already use this product, but now I have a vested interest. And so you have less of a need for paid advertisement because now I'm a walking billboard and I'm telling everyone about that. So I think that's a powerful message from the business's perspective, amongst other things that we can get into. From an investor's perspective, it's an opportunity to kind of take charge of how our communities develop. For instance, I live in Candler Park, and there's a main strip down Candler Park called McClendon Avenue. And at the end of it, there are a couple of different coffee shops. There's a Flying Biscuit that everyone knows about. Let's say, for instance, one of those were vacant. Now, I know someone in the neighborhood who's an innovator or a smart business owner who's just struggling, needs a little bit of capital to kind of get over the hump and open up their place. Now, I know I'm taking charge of who's now in there. And it's not just some random person coming in and who knows what kind of business they have. So, you know, that's on a very micro level. There are larger things on top of that. But something else that's very important to keep in mind, and Megan kind of touched on this, non-accredited investors have been excluded from this marketplace for a long time. And as I like to call it, a lot of smoke-filled rooms have been full with people making these deals, and they've profited handsomely from this. Now, that's not to say that that neighborhood coffee shop is going to be Facebook. It's not. But should they have success and experience success, they have an opportunity to make some money off of that. And again, play a role in their community's development. But the main thing is the opportunities out there, and there will be some people who will have home runs. And now we have access to this. And I think that's important from an investor's perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, the image that was coming to my mind when you were talking about developing communities, it's sort of like a financial version, if you want to think of it, of like a barn raising. You know, everyone says this place needs to be fixed up, so mm-hmm. we're going to pitch in together. And this is traditionally something that, you know, you can get in on the friends and family round, but you got to be friends or family. Right. So if you happen to not know that coffee shop owner personally, you never would have had the opportunity to come up and say, hey, I've got $5,000 I'd like to give you to start this.
Absolutely.
And now you have a marketplace to be able to do that. Absolutely. And invest in your local community. Well, that's wonderful. I really am glad you guys were on the show. We'll be talking more to you, Marcus, in just a little bit during the roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us, Megan. Whichever one of you wants to speak, tell us where they can find more information about Spark Market.
Well, we are on Facebook, Twitter. You can find us on our website, sparkmarket.com. And I guess those are our most active ways, and feel free to holler at us. As a matter of fact, we have an email address that is literally holler at us at sparkmarket.com. So feel free to reach out to us, and that'll usually be me who answers you back.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you for joining us, guys.
Thanks so much.
So next up, we've got Dr. Rodney Sampson from Opportunity Hub. His biography is outstanding. And I could probably spend my 5 minutes just listing all of the things he's done in the last 15 years, but we'll just stick with most recent stuff. He's the author of Kingonomics, and he also is the co-founder of Opportunity Hub, who is launching, I think, right now, I believe it's the largest equity-based crowdfunding campaign. It's very ambitious, and he's going to tell you all about it. So why don't we just jump right in, Rodney? Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's good to be with you. So, 15 plus years ago when I started my first tech company, there wasn't an ecosystem where you could go and get mentorship or just kind of navigate, entrepreneurship. You sort of had to figure it out on your own. And so 15 plus years later, I'm like, okay, what are some of the ways that I can give back to help Atlanta's culture, but Georgia and beyond? So Kingonomics evolved into a large-scale conference that we do annually here in Atlanta, now in D.C. as well. And we had a lot of the attendees saying, well, I had great exposure today. Okay, great. I learned about crowdfunding. I learned about, accounting. I learned about finance. I learned about social media. But where do I go to do this every day? I need to get out of my kitchen table. I need to get out of Starbucks. And I don't have a tech company. I have a tech play, but may not be a tech company. And so we created a space for, those people to come through, and we like to call it an ecosystem. So, in an ecosystem, you've got the coworkers, you've got the startups, you've got the early stage co-founders, but you also got the mentors. You've got people who've gone before, some have had great success, some have had great failure. And there's something to learn from both, right? So those are our mentors. And then you have the investors. Now, most people see those investors as being the accredited angels, and everybody's into Shark Tank now, so everybody's waiting for Mark Cuban to show up, or Damon John to pop up in your co-working space, which Damon has been to our space. So has Mark. So, but our philosophy is, if we're going to create a startup culture in Atlanta, we've got to have a mechanism by which the everyday person and entrepreneur can invest in an ecosystem before they think to withdraw from it. And so what we're discovering is most people get into this entrepreneurial drive, and they go after other people's money too quickly. But they don't know what an operating agreement is. They've never seen a securities document. They don't know what valuation is. They just know what they don't know they don't know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they don't even know that. So we've had to create this environment, and that's what we call the Opportunity Hub. And at the Opportunity Hub, we focus on three things: co-working, crowdfunding, and coding. So those are kind of the three things that we want to be known for. So when you look at co-working spaces across the country, and I make this fast, they're usually launched by a venture fund. Take WeWork out of the New York area, a venture fund back. Then you have like a super angel that basically, like our colleague David Collins in Atlanta, did with ATV. Then you have the public-private partnership with like an ATDC. And that's pretty much it. So how do we create something by the people for the people? And the only mechanism to do that in the state of Georgia is the Invest Georgia exemption, interstate crowdfunding, where we didn't want people to just get a perk and a pat on the back and say, oh, thank you. You did something really great and we really like what you're doing. But they're like, I can get a piece of that. And now I'm incentivized not to only use this space, but to also bring others into the ecosystem as well.
Yeah, that's what I think is so unique about your campaign. And we'll get to a moment where you can talk about it more. But when you sent me your packet about the campaign, I loved one of your questions was, why are you raising money this way? They're sitting, hey, wait a second. I see pictures of you sitting next to Mark Cuban. Why are you going the crowdfunding route? So why don't you speak to that a little bit? You have a great answer in your paperwork. So why don't you tell the folks now?
Sure. I mean, we had options. We could go to our angel community. We could go to our, our venture network or what have you. But we believe that we wanted to kind of take a stand and say, let's build an ecosystem whereby people can learn to be micro angels and investors themselves, so that, someone's got to jumpstart this culture, right? And what better business to do it in terms of a co-working space? So by doing this, we're seeing it now with people buying, you know, shares for $100. And I would say this is not an offer. I have to, my securities attorney would tell, this is not an offer. You'll learn to say that too. This is not an offer, just to get it out there. But what we're seeing, people who invest $100, we're seeing enlightenment happening. Their minds are shifting because they're like, wow, you mean I actually own a piece of something, like, for the first time? Like, I'm just not a consumer or a user, but now I'm a prosumer, that I actually own what I use, or I own what I produce, or what have you. And so we're seeing the light bulb come on. Imagine if once, we call it 1,000 founders, once we set off the light for 1,000 founders in our ecosystem, they're not going to want to stop investing. They're going to be looking for the next investment to do that. And imagine across the state of Georgia, if we activated 1 million micro angels, micro investors who invested just $100 a year. That's a $100 million fund, in essence, you know, or that's $100 million worth of capital. So I think when you look big, but you also bring small to some of the local types of opportunities that Marcus was talking about, you know, we've got to get this law activated. And so, you know, we're saying, hey, why not us? And that's why we decided to go this route with inviting the public for the first time to come in and actually crowdfund a co-working space.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm thinking, you know, it's kind of like day trading in a way, but with small companies, you know, you know, you're taking an investment. So you could take $10,000, invest in a few companies, and then when you can take out that investment, or things have worked out, you can then take that, you now have $20,000 you can invest in, you slowly build up. And
well, you know, it's like that. We call it the startup start market, you know, with a 5 to 7 year lockup period on your capital.
So why don't you talk about 1,000 founders, kind of give some of the details, whatever you can over the air,
sure,
about how they can reach you, how they can invest, and what they can get for that.
Absolutely. So we set up a microsite just to go get information, and we're really pleased to be partnering, of course, with Spark Market. You can always go to sparkmarket.com and click Opportunity Hub and learn more about the offering in itself. But we also created a microsite that kind of tells our story, how we got to this point. We want to be as transparent as possible. I mean, we have a link there that, you know, we have the traditional pitch video, and we're kind of breaking like all the rules because I don't believe the rules are set in stone yet. So our pitch video is not like 3 minutes, it's 6 minutes. You know, it's a little longer than what the industry says you should do. But we also have our pitch deck up there. But we even go deeper. We even have like our articles of a certificate of organization, like showing that we, you know, are actually a real company in the state of Georgia. We place that up there. We even have the GA1, the Invest Georgia exemption form that the state requires that you actually file. So we place that up there as well. We even went as far to put our operating agreement to actually show, you know, we authorize this offering and who the shareholders are and what are the types of shares or what have you. And that's pretty much it. And then we give the steps on how to actually invest in 1,000 founders. But actually, we've authorized 6,000 shares at $100 each, and we're raising a total of $600,000 for 20% of the company at a $3 million valuation. And the minimum investment is $1,000, but we do have a limited pool of what we call early bird shares of $100, which are perfect for college students or MBAs or professionals who just kind of want to get a piece of something to be a part of the ecosystem.
And how's it going so far?
So
when did you launch?
We've had like a soft launch probably 3 weeks ago. I would say 2 weeks ago is when we really got everything online. To date, and our goal for June is to raise our first 50,000, and we've gotten commitments for 25. And I want to say commitments because it's a process when a person says, I want to invest $1,000, and then they get a 45-page offering circular that they're like, wait a minute, you know, what is this? Yeah. Or they get an operating agreement. So as we're enlightening people, we're having to educate them that, no, this is the legal way you do it. You know, that guy that came with you with a piece of paper and was selling you securities, he wasn't legit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is how you're supposed to do it. But we're having to kind of shift people's minds and say, no, I have to take a copy of your driver's license. We have to certify that you're a Georgia resident. We also have to get a copy of your utility bill or something like that. That's step one. And you can do that through Spark Market. Then the next thing is we send you out the circular so you can review it. And then you have to sign that, and we have to collect that. Then we have to collect checks, and they can do that online, or if someone just prefers to bring us a check or what have you. So getting a commitment and getting the check in hand is more than a notion, but we're on our way.
Yeah, well, where I had significantly different than investing in getting a watch through Kickstarter, right? It's a totally different ballpark. Well, that's wonderful. Why don't you say the website again that they can go to check all this out?
Sure, absolutely. It's 1000founders.com. That's 1000founders.com.
All right, wonderful. And we'll hear back from you again, Rodney, when we go do the roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us today. So we're going to be going on to Catherine Mobley now, who is the Chief Marketing Officer for We Care Card. After spending the past 15-plus years in the advertising and PR world, Catherine decided it was time for a change and became the Chief Marketing Officer of We Care Card, which is a revolutionary crowdfunding technology powered with a prepaid debit card. Now, she's using her previous experiences of working with some of the world's largest brands, such as Coca-Cola, Dasani, Bank of America, to share the We Care Card story. Now, this is an exciting time for startups and a much faster pace than 1999. Of course, we were on dial-up back then. For more about her background, you can check out her LinkedIn profile, which is linkedin.com/in/Catherine Mobley. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you.
All right. So what's the story behind We Care Card?
Well, to piggyback on Rodney's testimony of transparency and education, we are a crowdfunding platform that is based upon social good and donation-based. So we are not equity crowdfunding, but we are here to support the equity crowdfunding market because we believe that with crowdfunding having raised $5.1 billion in 2013, and in 2012, 30% of that market was social good causes, period. It's shifting a little bit. So we have to be support of new platforms and new venues. So we're here to say that while it's a totally different market, we completely support what everyone here is doing, and that's why we wanted to be here today. We Care Card was created from our founder, Jessica Weiss, who was a NICU nurse for 19 years, who saw multiple people come in and out of the hospital trying to care for their young children and babies, and saw not only the personal tragedy, but the loss of income and the medical bills. And in 2009, her husband suffered a personal tragedy of an aneurysm, and she was placed in the shoes of her patients. And because of that, she received multiple donations from gift cards, restaurant cards, shopping cards, et cetera. And what she really needed was cash, period, point blank. She had a baby. She had four children. She needed to be able to put gas in the car, pay for a hotel if she needed to. And so she created this technology, which is a crowdfunding platform that you can go on and raise money for any type of social good cause or personal hardship, as well as raise money for any type of nonprofit you're trying to support. And then it will be tied to a prepaid debit card. So ultimately, you won't receive multiple transactions through the bank. You'll just have a reloadable GPR card that will be able to be used for any type of transactions you need.
Oh, that's a really unique idea.
Yes.
So what are some current campaigns? You guys have several campaigns up there, right?
We do. We are currently in beta phase. I do want to make that disclaimer. I do have a new website that will be unveiled most likely in late July, early August, along with the card. The card is currently under development and will be launched. Some of our campaigns we have right now is a young girl, 9 years old, discovered that she had a tumor behind her eye, and she lives here in Cumming, Georgia, but her family has to seek treatment in Jacksonville. So her entire family, two siblings and a mother and father, have been relocated to Jacksonville to seek treatment for an extensive period of time. So obviously they're going to need a lot of money, not only for hospital bills, but travel expenses, food, et cetera. We also have a young gentleman, Ryan Cox, in Indianapolis, who's raising money to wipe out deficit lunchroom accounts for students within the area, because he knows for a fact that a lot of these children, that may be the only meal they get every day. So he has a campaign, hashtag feed the kids, which is all based upon the fact that he wants to raise money to relinquish these accounts that are deficit, and these kids need to have a healthy meal. We have a 42-year-old woman that's losing a battle to colon cancer who wants to raise money directly to the Colon Cancer Alliance. So it's various different causes.
Sure, sure. Now, what is it that really differentiates We Care Card from other crowdfunding platforms?
Great question. At the end of the day, we have a crowdfunding technology platform. So we have our website where you can go and create a campaign. But what's truly going to differentiate us is the fact that we are tied to a prepaid debit card. Ultimately, there is our technology is patent pending, not only just nationally, but internationally. And basically, that will allow people to have a seamless transaction from start to finish, which currently is not in the marketplace.
Wonderful. So What are your goals next 5 years? How is this going to grow?
Obviously, we have our own campaigns and our own platform that we're working on, but we will be able to take this technology and white label it. So if you're an organization that needs a crowdfunding platform, not only for the actual campaigns themselves, but ultimately to white label the card. So if you're a large institution and you don't want to go out, and trust me, you don't want to go out and create this technology and you don't want to go through the banking process of creating a debit card, we are going to be able to white label that technology and provide that opportunity for people to take it. And it can be powered by WeCare Card or it can be completely theirs and they own it. We're just on the back end. So we've basically built it out so that other people can use it as well.
And let's finish up here. What are some misconceptions about crowdfunding in general and about WeCare Card?
Yes. I believe from donation-based crowdfunding, social good, all the way to equity crowdfunding, I think we can all agree in this room that people think that they can just go out and create a campaign, build it, and they will come. And that does not happen. You really have to go out there and educate people. There is a huge lack of education within the crowdfunding arena, not only from our standpoint, but from people when you even look them in the eye and say, you know, I got a crowdfunding campaign. If you say Kickstarter, they get it, or Indiegogo, they might. But even people in the business world are like, I don't even know what that is. I don't know what you're talking about. My parents look at me like a deer in headlights. They wouldn't have a clue. So I think there's a huge area of education that we have to create and make sure that people understand that you have to get the masses rallied around it. You have to get people educated and you have to get people to support your cause or your equity-based crowdfunding or your movie or whatever it may be.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Catherine. We'll be talking to you a little bit later during the roundtable. Next up, we have the unfortunate black sheep here. Andrew McConnell is from Vacation Futures. They have very little to do with crowdfunding, actually. But Andrew is going to be speaking at our Ritz Group event coming up about his funding journey. He has a company, Vacation Futures, which has works out of Atlanta Tech Village. They have received angel investment, 2 rounds, I believe, now. They've got an amazing platform for vacation rentals, and he'll tell you all about it. But I wanted to make sure you guys knew why he was here. I wanted to get his story out there and promote that he's going to be at the Ritz Group meeting this Thursday, talking more about his company and his funding journey. So Andrew McConnell, initially, he came up with the idea for Vacation Futures after hearing two vacation homeowners who were self-managing their properties tell horror stories of the time and hassle that was involved. And so with his undergraduate degree from Harvard College, law degrees from Harvard Law School and Cambridge University, and experience working with some of the largest companies in the world during his time at McKinsey & Co. and Axiom Global Incorporated, Andrew is excited to apply all that he has learned to the vacation rental industry in order to create a better experience for homeowners, rental managers, and renters alike. So thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, tell the people what Vacation Futures is.
Yeah, so we are a wholesale marketplace for vacation rentals. If people are familiar with the vacation rental space, typically it's through companies like HomeAway or VRBO or even Airbnb. And what all of those are really retail markets. They allow a homeowner or even a rental manager to rent out a vacation property or a second home for a night, a week at a time. And so they really try to attract consumers. And what we saw is with the internet, you definitely can have a democratization, right? Everybody can do everything because internet and technology enables it. There's kind of a reason that the United States isn't a democracy. It's actually a republic, is that we kind of believe in specialization of labor. And just because we could go do, you know, 10-hour jobs and have 50 different jobs, we say, actually, I'm really good at this. I want to do this as a full-time job, not all these other part-time pieces. So while VRBO and Airbnb have allowed homeowners to go manage these homes themselves, what it's turned into is that they're having to spend over 8.5 hours every single week doing that. And if you think about the profile of person who can afford a second home, can afford a vacation home, their opportunity costs tend to be pretty high. They're getting paid enough money in their current job that they were able to afford that second home. So for them to spend 8.5 hours, 10 hours a week having to manage it, it's not a good trade-off for them. They're missing their kids' soccer games. They're not working as hard as they could at their day job. Their golf games falling apart. So what we came into and said, well, why don't we just let these homeowners take all the weeks that they're not using the house themselves, and they bundle that into a single package. And then on the other side of our marketplace, instead of these consumers that are trying to book a night or a week at a time, will have professional rental managers. This is what they do for a living. They are at scale. They have their own website. They know how to advertise. They know how to clean. They know how to market. And we'll let them actually bid against each other to buy these rental weeks from the homeowners. And so the homeowner gets a single transaction, gets a guaranteed price that's market derived, so they're getting the best possible price. And then these rental managers are buying wholesale, which then enables them to chop it up and go rent it out retail. And all of this leads to a much better experience for the renter. Because one thing we didn't touch on is, great, Airbnb's fantastic, VRBO, HomeAway, you can go book a home directly with the homeowner. What's getting increasing coverage right now is there are a lot of scams going on. People taking photos off Craigslist, elsewhere, posting it. You show up at the house and the people who are living there say, I never rented this. I don't know what you're talking about. Or even if you get the real house, on average on those sites, on HomeAway, VRBO, it takes 9 days on average to book a vacation rental right now because you're calling the neurosurgeon who doesn't return his calls for a week and a half because he's busy because he's a neurosurgeon. But by putting it in the hands of these professional rental managers, it becomes much more like booking a hotel. You book through a website. You can have instant booking. There's a brand behind it. There's customer support. Everything's much more seamless, much more comfortable. And so that's how we're actually trying to increase the professionalism within this industry. Kind of we've seen – I draw the parallel with eBay, that you look at early days – eBay came in and said, wait, we can disintermediate a lot of these big businesses that are selling things. We can let the soccer mom sell a Beanie Baby directly to this other soccer mom. And if you look at what eBay's become and what it is now, it's the vast majority of transactions are actually from power sellers. They're people who got on that platform and said, wow, I'm actually really good at this. This could be a full-time job. It's Nasty Girl who built a $100 million business on an eBay backbone. And that's what I think we're going to start seeing in the vacation rental space. And so we're just enabling those companies to get to scale more quickly.
And can consumers get rooms or get vacation rentals through your platform?
No. I mean, I don't even know how they find us because we don't advertise at all. Not only do we not advertise to consumers, but we don't advertise at all. But still we'll have people saying, oh, I'm going to Myrtle for this family reunion. Can I book this house? I said, absolutely not. Like, it's selling for 9 months. You know, you have to be a licensed rental manager. You can't possibly better touch this. So we really are not trying to get in a very, very crowded consumer space. I mean, the AdWords for things like this are incredibly expensive because of Airbnb, HomeAway, Flipkey, HouseTrip. There are many multi-billion dollar businesses doing that, and we very deliberately are staying as far away from that as possible.
So when did you launch?
We were doing it kind of offline mid last year, and the site went up around October and November of 2013. And we're currently live all over the US, all over North America, into the Caribbean, South America, Asia, and Europe.
Wow. Wow. And what's kind of your 5-year plan?
Take over the world.
Yeah.
we want to be the global marketplace for this. I mean, what you see, when I said we don't spend any money on advertising, that's not entirely true. We probably spend a total of $200 or $300 on some AdWords or Facebook campaigns. But we are literally the only place in the world that's doing this. And as a result, we wake up and we have registrations in Thailand, in Serbia and Montenegro, in Tortola. And because there's no other avenue for people, every homeowner wants this. Not every. They're kind of some people who want to micromanage, or they're stay at home moms or retirees that just say, look, I enjoy doing this. I'm great at it. But about 70 to 80% of homeowners say, yeah, of course. Someone wants to give me guaranteed income and I can just use the home when I want. Why wouldn't I do that? And that's our response. Why wouldn't you do this? I don't understand. So yeah, it's the goal is really to get as global and as big as we possibly can.
All right. So you're going to be speaking on Thursday,
yes,
at the Ritz Group meeting before our shark attack. I don't want to steal that talk's okay thunder, but why don't you give people a little like taste of what it is that you're going to be talking, maybe a 2-sentence synopsis of what you'll be talking about.
Talking about the fundraising journey of going from self-funding through accelerators, through the angel rounds, through multiple angel rounds, from going to losing more money in commitments than we actually ended up with in the end in our first round, to people giving us money and asking to invest when we didn't need money and didn't want it in the first place, but our investors saying, don't be stupid, take the money.
Sure.
So kind of it's a winding road.
Yeah. So if anyone listening owns a vacation rental that you're looking to, yes, unload on a property manager, where can they find you?
The best is our website, vacationfutures.com, futures with an S. You can email me directly, andrew.mcconnell@vacationfutures.com, or on Twitter, we're @vacationfutures.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew. Maybe you'll have something to offer on the equity-based crowdfunding talk in just a little bit. But thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Last up, we have Mr. Brett Grayson, who is from Good Country Films. He is actually doing a crowdfunding campaign for his film on Spark Market. Now, from a Marine to an attorney to a film producer, Brett's professional experience spans an very obviously an impressive spectrum. Thank you so much for joining us, Brett.
Basically, what I do is solve problems, everything from janitors to judges. That's what I do. And I'm here today on behalf of Good Country Pictures. And what Good Country Pictures does and is trying to do is tell compelling stories. Why would we want to do that? Well, our belief is that white papers and think tanks and research and all these things are incredibly important in the world. But what actually moves human beings is compelling stories. And I think there's probably somewhere in a cabinet a white paper on how amazing crowdfunding could be. And equity-based crowdfunding. It's probably been in a drawer since 1987. but you're here today because people have a compelling story to tell. A, Spark Market's got a story to tell about the platform itself. But then you have the We Care card, and you've got Rodney's project with Opportunity Hub. And all of these things are compelling stories in and of themselves on the platform. That's what moves human beings, and that's what we're about. Specifically, we care about stories that involve the intersection of the natural and supernatural worlds. We think it's a mistake when people get locked in and forget that there's more to life than the material world. And so those are the stories we focus on. Specifically, the project we're developing right now is a film based on Flannery O'Connor's novel, The Violent Bear It Away, one of the two novels that she wrote, and the novel she considered to be her best one. And we're excited. We've been through two angel rounds, not as many as Andrew perhaps, but we've been through two angel rounds and had success. We acquired the rights to the intellectual property. We executed that option, and now we have 5 years to make the film. In the last month, we have a completed script from Brent Hanley, who's best known for the screenplay for Frailty, which is a 2001 film starring Matthew McConaughey and Bill Paxton. And we felt like with all of our fundraising going around the state, lots of traditional meetings with accredited investors, but also I spoke to anybody and everybody, church groups, literary society, any group. There was no group too small, too large, whatever, to spread the word about our project. And what I experienced was that there were huge groups of people that are fans of Flannery, would love to see her work adapted to film, but could not participate in our original offerings, which are typically, investing in $50,000 units or more. And when I found out about Spark Market and the Invest Georgia exemption, I thought it was a perfect way to experiment, but also open up what we're trying to do with this film to the larger audience.
Yeah, it's interesting is that, everyone really likes movies. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. I guess I assume it's actually probably a $1 trillion industry. It's massive, right? So, and yet I think the average person has absolutely no idea how a film gets made from a financing perspective. Shed a little light on that.
Sure. And I'm certainly no expert. I've learned a lot just through the 2x4 method in the last 3 years. But you can basically divide it into three sections. You have the development phase, the production phase, and the distribution phase. Development involves, and this is what we're doing, acquiring intellectual property, developing a script, putting together your package, which means your key actors, your director, and possibly also co-production partners. From there, and that takes its own money, and that's the money we're raising. From there, you move on to the production phase. So this is generally going to be another round of financing, and there's a lot of ways to raise money for the production budget. They're all difficult. You may get funding from a major studio. You may get it from a group of smaller independent studios. You may raise it all from private individuals or some combination thereof. Once that is done and you actually have the movie filmed, you're going to move on to the distribution phase. And that takes more money, which may come from the studio, may come from people who specialize in distribution. And so those are the three phases. And each time, more money has to be raised, and it's different people. But the long and short of it is for the average investor, their chance to get in comes in the beginning at the development phase. And they're usually trading cash for equity. and then they're asked to wait and wait and wait. And if the movie gets made and distributed and it actually makes money, which is incredibly rare, 10% of the time, maybe less, then they get paid many, many, many years hence. And this is another thing that we really were excited about Spark Markets platform and the Invest Georgia Extension 4, because it allowed us to experiment and tweak this model. Because we're offering a debt-based raise. And what this does allows people to get in at a smaller level, and then as soon as we raise, if we raise the production budget, our development investors get paid out with a small a bump on their initial investment. So okay. we're basically offering people a chance to hit a single and get out without having to wait two, three, to infinity to get some returns on a film.
That's great. That's great. So before we jump into the roundtable section of all of this, let's tell me a little bit about what the movie is going to be about. You do have a script now.
We do.
Don't go into whatever you can't tell me about, but tell us a little bit about what the film's about, and if you have any actors attached that people might have heard about, let's generate some interest. Let's get people to
invest. Don't have any actors attached at this point, although I did have lunch with Mel Gibson.
Okay.
That was strange. If you've seen Lethal Weapon, that's basically what he's like in real life. So we don't have any actors attached, and I'm just kidding. He's a very nice man at this point. The story is really about Flannery O'Connor's genius. I mean, that's what we're trying to accomplish, is translating her genius from the original text into the film. Now, there's no surprise ending that I can tell you, because there isn't one. We're being true to the novel, and if you want to read the novel, you can figure out what the script's going to be about. In a nutshell, it's a deranged quest for baptism that takes place in the Deep South of the 1950s. All of that is set up basically to explore the places in human beings where redemption and ruin battle for territory. That's really what it's about. It's a human drama, the dark side of life. I've been watching True Detective lately, and that's kind of what it's about, like the dark places of the soul that we all deal with when things get quiet.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I'm in a book club, and the one rule is that it has to be a book that no one else has read it before. And unfortunately, the people I'm in a book club with have read like all of Flannery O'Connor's work. So they're always like, I'm always like, I want to read it with you guys, but they've already read it. So it always gets passed up. But when I told them about this project, they were like, this is going to be awesome.
Well, that's kind of what I got clued into as I've been around the state, is that there are no like neutral Flannery folks. They're either hardcore aficionados or they've never heard of her. And I get a lot of, oh, I've never heard of him reactions. But when people know, they love her. And that's who we're trying to reach in this group. Say, we get it. You can't come in at 50,000, but we want your help. We want you to be an insider and participate with us in this project.
So where can they, how can they do that?
Yeah, actually, our landing page for the crowdfunding campaign has just gone live, so they can go to violentflannery.com to check that out. There's a video they can watch to get a little bit better feel for our vision. And in the coming weeks, we'll do our launch on sparkmarket.com. So we're excited.
All right. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, you're welcome to join us on Thursday if you can make it. We have our industry group leader program. You may not have heard of it, but we have two of the big industries we're working with is entertainment and technology. So Kat Phillips is our IGL who helps with film finance. So certainly I'd be happy to introduce you guys. So let's I allotted 35 minutes and we're down to about 12 for the round table. This is how it usually happens with me. Thank you all for joining us. So let's just dive right into it. Is equity-based crowdfunding the future of investment?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the definitive future of investment. I would say it is a part of the puzzle. The experience that I draw from with this is a little known fact for most is that equity crowdfunding has been happening for 8 years in Australia to a smaller degree, and to a greater degree, it's been going on for 3 years in the UK. And so what they're discovering is that equity crowdfunding is playing a part, and it's kind of filling in the gap where banks chose to evacuate. Maybe not chose is probably the wrong word. They were forced to evacuate. And so equity crowdfunding, amongst other forms of alternative financing, are filling the gap. And I think that is a way forward. I don't want to take everyone else's time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always the disruptive one here. So, but I mean, I think a little bit of it is even just semantics in the conversation. I mean, you know, even most, you know, angel deals or even small rounds could be even considered to be small crowds of people. You know what I mean? What we're seeing is the evolution by which larger crowds of people get to do something they've never done before. And so I think that therein lies, you know, the opportunity and what we've seen in Australia, of course, what we're seeing in Europe, and even with, you know, at the federal level with, you know, Jobs Act, Title II, you know, I don't know if that's authentically, you know, crowdfunding the way we envision it. We, you know, there are even people in the industry talking about changing it, like, should it be crowd investing, you know, so that we're not lumped in with Kickstarter or, you know, Jobs or what have you. So I think it's just saying, I think it's a potential game changer because you get an influx of people who are going to require a lot of education at each step of the way. Because, I mean, we're preparing for it. We're talking about 1,000 founders. You know there's going to be that one person who gets that $100 share that's going to be like, when can I liquidate this? Or why didn't I get my quarterly report? And what's my return? And it's like, I'm going to have to refer you back to your operating agreement and to the offering circular. And I think we're just going to have to do that over and over again. So, you know, we got a lot of work to do.
And that education point is going to be on both sides.
Yes.
I mean, I think people used to dealing with five big investors that can be very flexible. It is going to be different when you have 1,000 founders that you're dealing with. And so it's not just educating the people on one side. It's, well, what does this actually mean for the businesses, the people running them?
Having been in the technology industry in 99 versus what it is now, I kind of view it as the way back then it was the internet. It was this new widget that everyone got that was the internet, which created the last boom. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of propelling it to a whole new level where it's not a traditional thing. So no one knows what it is. No one understands it. You got to educate. But once people become educated and they see it as a benefit or something that they can rally behind, I think it's going to actually propel some companies that otherwise probably would not have gotten funded or would not have gotten your traditional round. So to me, I think it opens up the world to some innovative new ideas that we're just not necessarily educated or prepared for. But once the word gets out, I think they'll be embraced.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's standardizing this process that has been occurring. You know, you said you love the Godfather movies. In a way, you know, the mafia would pool resources in order to start different businesses and fund their companies or their community. You know, I mean, this is not, the concept is nothing new, but the standardizing of it is changing things.
When you talk about standardization, I mean, you know, one of the things I like about the partnership with Spark Market and then our securities law firm, you know, Push to Start, Scott Massar and his team, is we're thinking down the road. We're thinking about, you know, and we had to carve this out in the operating agreement. Okay, we've got a crowd of 1,000 people. When we hit certain, you know, event points, like we get a, let's say this is pre-Series A, right? So let's say we go into a Series A round and we get another angel or a VC group interested in investing at least $1 million, or a certain amount of time has passed or what have you, we elect to pay either a dividend or we elect to buy those shares back. We have to think about how will future investors think about getting in a company that's got this crowd over here of people who have a pro rata vote, and that pro rata vote may not ever give them majority, you know, their vote may not shift the vote or what have you, but we have to think about minority shareholder rights, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to think about all of that. So I think we're having the forward conversation to put systems and best practices in place so other companies, as they come along, or the fact that Brett's thinking about a debt deal, you know, in an interstate offering to create a culture where people feel like I can invest and I will get my money back, you know, earlier potentially. And even also talking about the importance of understanding the risk. I mean, I think the recession has helped people in Wall Street, you know, in the markets understand that there's even a risk in public securities. But, you know, that was kind of like off limits before the recession. People just didn't think that you could ever see a downturn or down spiral there. So, you know, that conversation even helps us balance that. Yes, this is a risk as well, but you get to participate in actually helping make this a success, mm-hmm. whereas you kind of got to sit back and just kind of like, you know, keep hitting ticker symbol on your iPad, hoping that's going to drive it up, and it doesn't.
you know, if I can like piggyback on something Rodney was, I think, alluding to is, and just to tie everything together, quite frankly, there's a lot of education to go on here. And that even happens for downstream investors. And that would be VCs or angels who would look to participate in later capital rounds. For instance, our very first funded company, Bohemian Guitars, was recently accepted into 500 Startups, which is an incubator, an accelerator out in Mountain View, California. And their head man, Dave McClure, who happens to be very progressive with a lot of his views on capital raising, he has it said explicitly where he sees VCs and angels starting to understand and appreciate the value of the crowd. And he recently drew up a diagram where he saw crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding, as just kind of the tip of that, and then some early stage angels, and down from there, VCs. He just created a whole flow chart of how the progression of raising funds can happen in the future. And there's an education aspect there, because we've spoken to many angels or even VCs who've been negative on the concept of crowdfunding, and to Rodney's point, handling all these different investors who are partaking in the raise. And I think as people like Dave McClure and others accept it and take it in and show that this is a very viable model and it's not something to be afraid of, because there's a lot of ways that we can structure the equity to make it friendly and acceptable for downstream investors. So again, we have an education hump to get over, and it's on all ends.
In crafting future, like kind of the future policy, forward thinking for those downstream investors, how much are you borrowing from just publicly traded companies? Because they have to deal with, that's the whole point. They're dealing with a mob of 40% of their companies owned by a million people, right, with three shares in Apple, and that person has a voice of some sort. It's a very small voice, but they have a voice. I mean, it seems to me there is a model for how to handle the mob, if you want to think of it that way. But it seems like it's almost in reverse, right? Mm-hmm. Now you're almost getting a lot of people involved very early, instead of you take it public and, then right, you get out and you're done, right? Now you're almost taking it public before all of that, as your angel round is taking it public.
No, that's very much the case. And, I mentioned what's happening in the UK. One of the largest platforms out there is Crowdcube. And there's another one called Cedars. They're kind of one and two. And both of them have built into their model an investor relations piece. And that's often a part that we hear as we speak with small business owners. They're very fearful of this. They don't want Joe Schmo to come into a brewery and, demand that this and that has changed. We're going to build out an infrastructure around that where nothing exists now to help alleviate those concerns. But again, it's kind of hard to drill down and say one particular way is what's going to happen, is because we can help structure the input and how an investor would interact with that owner. So there's still a lot of uncertainty around that. But my major point here is that we're going to build out the infrastructure to help take that fear off their backs, because it's somewhat overplayed. Rodney's talking about 1,000 investors. He's clearly not overly concerned about that because he's prepared beforehand, and it's without, completely devaluing the input of those people. And, if Rodney wants to talk more about that, I'd invite him to do so.
No, I want to leverage it. I kind of look at, some of the work we've had with faith-based organizations. I mean, I have a lot of respect, for, whether it's a pastor, a rabbi, or imam, or what have you. I mean, they're kind of leading a community, right? And those members or constituents feel like they have a stake in helping to build that church and build that community. And so that pastor has to be wise, or that leader has to be wise, in how he engages with each and every person and kind of where they are.
And then what they do is when a person comes with a problem, oh, I got last month's quarterly statement and you guys didn't really hit, you know, your revenue projections. And then I say, well, you know, as a shareholder, you're able to invite people to come and be a part of the community. Oh, yeah, I forgot that. You know, so I think it's just kind of building that team. And we, you know, in our particular business, we understand that we're going to have a community manager that's going to have a special relationship. You know, they're not just managing the community, but they're thinking about, these people are now thinking about being investors. And so how do you mentor people who are thinking about investors? And I think that's a whole new paradigm that we're going to have to evolve into. But it's exciting. We got to do it.
Yeah, and the idea being a whole new paradigm, I would challenge that you'd want to copy a broken system around the publicly traded market. Yeah. I mean, that's a cobbled-together system with Sarbanes-Oxley, everything that's required there. I think this is a beautiful opportunity to build something from scratch that actually services everybody's needs. And so building from a zero-based design of what is actually the most beneficial for investors, for the companies, for downstream investors, I think that's where this is really going to be innovative and exciting.
Yeah. I mean, even with like Dave McClure, you know, if I were leading an angel network, you know, out in the Valley or in Atlanta, company comes in, the new model for customer discovery could be crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. If you're able to actually go out and get 50 people to pre-order something and they've agreed to all pay a certain price, you know, and there'll be a variation of that. When you come forward with that, you're telling me that, okay, you've gone through the ideation stage. You've gone, it's just not like the traditional boot camp. Yeah, check off the list. Yeah, we did it. You got the proof by showing us what happened on your platform. So I think once accredited investors, you know, angels or VCs are able to leverage it as a tool, it's legislation and technology. And then whenever you add people to the equation, you know, it's going to be some navigating that has to go on. But, you know, just like you said, you know, let's not copy the old paradigm. Let's create something totally new. It won't be perfect. And we're probably in this 20 years, you know, this is a journey.
Yeah. So, Brett, you actually, you know, you're going through this. We only have just a few more minutes. How do you prepare for a crowdfunding campaign?
Lots of prayer. Well, we think about it internally, obviously, and we brainstorm. And just to touch on something Rodney just said, leveraging the crowd, you know, we spent a lot of time thinking about the folks that love Flannery are excited about this project. How can we invite them into the circle? So a couple of things we've been thinking about are, okay, look, we have a list. It's a very simple list, 2 pages of actors that we think are right for the main parts of the movie. But what we'd like to do is send out an email to our investors, whether they put in $20 or $500, and say, who do you think should play Raber? Who do you think should play Tarwater? What are your favorite scenes? What do you think is the most important scene? And you may get some ideas that you didn't have. And you might get from the composite a real insight into, okay, we didn't really see this, but this scene is pivotal. We can't cut this. This has got to be in the script, and the director and all of those folks who are in charge of putting that vision on the screen, this is really valuable information. Plus, now your crowd is really buying into the product. So that's one way we're looking at leveraging the crowd in the film space. Now, back to your original question, managing and getting prepared for a crowdfunding race. For me, it involved a ton of education, because I promise you I'm behind everyone at this table when it comes to social media. I think Marcus can vouch for that. So it's been a accelerated learning curve for me, Twitter, Facebook, all of those different things. How do we get to our crowd? And it's a little bit, every crowd is different. So it's been studying that space, thinking about what to offer those folks once we get there, and then a lot of help on the legal side from Spark Market's internal team and some of our outside counsel, cobbling together documents that are legally sufficient. But from my perspective, I really push for clear and as concise a documents as you can have. There's a lot of boilerplate that is not necessary in these documents. And to Andrew's point, that all comes from the world of publicly traded companies, and it's garbage, you know. We got to educate people on the risk, but let's put together documents that the layman can read and understand what is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. This is wonderful. We have Brett Grayson. We have Andrew McConnell. We got the folks from Spark Market, Marcus Kennedy and Megan Johnson. We had Catherine Mobley on the show. We had Dr. Rodney Sampson. Thank you all for joining us. This has been the latest episode of Ritz Group Radio Show. I'm Trace Crowe, the host. Join us this Thursday, June 12th at 4:30 to around 8 for our networking event in Shark Attack. You can find us online, ritzgroup.org. And it's just $15 if you sign up in advance, $20 at the door, and you'll get to see Andrew McConnell speak. You'll get to see Rodney pitch his O-Hub. You're going to get to see a lot of cool things going down. The guys from Spark Market will be there talking about Spark Market. It's going to be a great event. So join us this Thursday, June 12th. Thank you all so much for joining us, and have a wonderful afternoon.